Vayehi bishalach paro es ha'am velo nacham Elohim derech eretz pelishtim ki karovu ki amar Elohim pen yinachem ha'am birosam milchama v'shavu mitzrayma. And it was when Paro sent the nation out that God did not allow them to go derech eretz plishtim. There are many interpretations of that, but let's say by the straightest path to Eretz Yisrael, because it was close. And God said, maybe the people will panic and regret when they see potential war, and they'll go back to Egypt. So he took them on a circuitous route. We'll talk more about that pasuk in a moment. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Bishalach. The Shabbat is also known as Shabbat Shira. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 11th day of Shabbat, 5780, corresponding this year to February 6th. First, let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, and then we'll get down to the business of the Seder. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashivot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai miya amod. Ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mishomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashivya ha-omedim mebein bayam uvein v'yabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara l'yirvacha. ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב ונאמר אמן. Before we get really into the Sedra, or let's put it this way, I'd like to get into the Sedra sort of in the middle, and then we'll go back to the beginning. There is a time-honored custom to feed birds on Erev Shabbat Shira. First of all, I say Erev Shabbat Shira, which is Friday, and not on Shabbat itself, because there are halachic problems in feeding birds of the wild, meaning birds that don't belong to anybody, on Shabbat. So the custom sort of evolved into a Friday Erev Shabbat Shira custom. There are two reasons that are given, and both of them fall under the heading of Hakarat HaTov, recognition of a good that somebody or someone gives, does for you. And it therefore stands as a lesson on all kinds of Hakarat HaTov, the gratitude that we have to show God every day, and the gratitude that we have to show our fellows, parents and children and siblings and friends. And when, you know, the occasion comes. The two go like this. We find in Beshalach the song of the sea, Shirat Hayam. Shirat Hayam is the song that Bnei Israel, the people of Israel, sang with Moshe after they crossed through the split sea and after the Egyptians were drowned in the sea, and therefore the total subjugation to Egypt ended at this point. Even though 1 week earlier we had physically gone out of Egypt, there still was that looking over your shoulder and then seeing Paro and his army pursuing the Jewish people. And this event of Kriyat Yamsuf ended that subjugation completely. The concept of singing is one that is attributed by nature to birds. People talk, birds sing. We borrowed, so to speak, the talent of the birds in singing the song of the sea, Oz Yoshir Moshe, Ufnei Yisrael. And as a token of gratitude, we are cognizant of the fact that birds in the wintertime can use a little helping hand in getting food and putting out grain and seeds and whatever else birds like to eat on the Erev Shabbat Shira. Now, technically speaking, we really should be feeding the birds all through the winter when food is difficult to come by, and that's not a bad idea. But the focus here is on Erev Shabbat Shira as a token of gratitude for lending us the talent of singing in order to sing this praise to God. There's a second part to the story, and it is also found in Parshat Beshalach, and it's based on Midrashim. The people complained that they were hungry and didn't have any food. Our commentaries tell us that the supply of unleavened bread, which they had from Egypt, had finished, and they were hungry. And God told Moshe to tell the people that he would be bringing a daily miracle called the manna, food from heaven, bread from the sky, so to speak. And there were guidelines for it. Each day they were to go out and collect what mun they needed for the day. And they were not to leave over for the next day. And sadly, the Torah has to tell us that there were people who kept it and left it over out of fear of it running out. And it had dissipated and rotted overnight. Then the instruction was that on the sixth day, Friday, Yom Shishi, the mun would fall in a double quantity. The people were to collect a double quantity and use what they used on Friday and prepare the rest for use on Shabbat, because on Shabbat, the mun would not fall. Sadly, the Torah has to tell us that there were people who went out to collect mun on Shabbat, and they didn't find any. The Midrash says that God sent birds early in the morning to eat up. Let me go back one step. We are told that Datan and Aviram, old nemesis of Moshe Rabbeinu, took mun that they had left over from Friday early, early Shabbat morning and scattered it around the camp with intention of coming out a little bit later and telling the people, take a look. Moshe told us no man will fall. What do you call this? So Moshe is not telling us the truth, and who knows if we could trust Moshe for anything that he says. God sent birds early in the morning to eat the man that Datan and Aviram had spread through the camp. And when they called people together to show them the man that had supposedly fallen on Shabbat, there wasn't any. And thereby, Moshe's reputation and God's reputation, so to speak, were upheld. And as a debt of gratitude to the birds, the custom developed to feed them on Shabbat Shira. And as I've already mentioned, really on Erev Shabbat Shira, to avoid halachic difficulties in feeding birds that you don't own and are not responsible for on Shabbat. So there's a double hakorat hatov, a double recognition of good, of gratitude that we have to show, and the birds are the recipients. I like to sum it up by saying this Friday, which is tomorrow, take a bird to lunch. On a personal note, and as a personal suggestion, I have found over the last number of years, it is a very nice experience to bring your children and grandchildren into the picture. Maybe it's obvious, but maybe some people don't do it. And make a fuss about feeding the birds on Shabbat, Erev Shabbat Shira, explaining to the children why we do it, and then have them join you in spreading seeds and feeding the birds. Also, on a personal experience, when you put out stuff for the birds, you don't necessarily find them, but they will come back later and eat. By the way, the opening music is a challenge to connect it with the show. So I will repeat my email, ttTorahTidbits@ouisrael.org, no IL, ttOuisrael.org. If you can explain why I started the show with that music. Let's go back now to the opening pasuk. I've always been disturbed by the idea of Vayehi b'shalach paro et ha'am, that it was Pharaoh who sent the people out. There's a lot of emphasis about God taking us out of Egypt and via Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu's name is hardly mentioned in the Haggadah of Pesach to emphasize that he was only a shaliach, but that it was God himself who took us out of Egypt. There's actually one reference to Moshe because they're quoting a pasuk, and his name is in that pasuk, but other than that, he's not part of the story, even though he was a major player. So why do we have Vayehi b'shalach paro et ha'am? And one of the answers that's given is that there was a perception, even though it had been made clear and emphasized that it was God that was taking us out and that Paro was allowing it because he didn't want to suffer any more punishment. And therefore, it should not have been Vayehi b'shalach Paro et ha'am. But the perception on the part of Paro himself and his people, and probably many Jews, was that, thank you, Paro, for letting us go finally. And that has to be tackled, which it was very well in the beginning of this week's Parsha, because it's as if it says, and when supposedly Paro sent us out of Egypt, my word supposedly is in parentheses, then he changed his mind, which was a real dumb thing to do if you think about it, and said, I regret having let the people go. Let's go after them and bring them back. And he takes an elite military force with him, and he pursues the people. Then it becomes very, very clear that Paro didn't send us out. So you don't have any when he supposedly sent us out, because he pursued us and his entire army was drowned. So it became clearer at that moment that it was God who took us out of Egypt. I also want to repeat something I've mentioned in the last couple of weeks. The concept of our knowing clearly that it was God who took us out of Egypt is extremely important. The vision and prophecy that Moshe Rabbeinu had at the burning bush, God says, as a sign that it is actually me who sent you, will be that you will come back to this location, namely Har Sinai, and serve me here. In the prophecy that was transmitted to the people at the beginning of Parshat Vaera, we have, V'hayiti lachem le'lokim, I will be for you as a god, V'lokachti etchem li la'am, I will take you unto me as a nation, V'hayiti lachem le'lokim, and I will be your god. And then, V'datem, ki ani Hashem Elokeichem hamotzi etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim. Then you will know that it is, and you will know that it is I who took you out. It's a very significant part of the experience of the Exodus. And the proof of that to me is that we have a tradition that we heard direct communication from God only two psukim, two verses. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beit avadim, lo yielecho Elohim achirim al ponai. And there are some versions of the Chumash which actually have that as one pasuk. God's opening statement of the Aseret HaDibrot, of the Ten Commandments, was, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. There shall not be any other gods before me. So, and then we panicked, and Moshe started to talk to us, and God thought it was a good idea, etc., etc. But that which God actually spoke to the people, to millions of people, is to tell them that I am the one who took you out of Egypt. That's how important that is, and that's how strange I felt with the terminology of Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am. Until we get to one of my favorite psukim in B'shalach, maybe in the whole Torah, not my favorite, but one of them, and that is that as the Egyptians were pursuing the Jewish people, the Jews who were crossing the sea on dry land, the land under them turned boggy, as would be the nature of a seabed, and caused their wheels of the chariots to get stuck. And you can close your eyes and imagine the abrupt transition from arrogance and confidence to utter panic. One second, they were in control. The next second, their wheels bogged down and fell off, and they realized that things are not going to go in their favor. So that, again, is, you think, Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am? Sorry, he didn't send us out. God took us out, and this put that whole anti fact claim to rest. Mitzvot. From Parshiot Nitzavim Vayelech Azinu Vizot HaBracha, the last four sedras in Devarim, and the 12 sedras of Bereshit, and the first two sedras of Shemot and Vo'era, we had a run of 18 sedras, which is exactly one-third of the 54 sedras, 18 sedras that had a total of 5 mitzvot out of 613, which means one-third of the Torah contains 5 mitzvot, and the other two-thirds of the Torah have the other 608. That's very disproportionate. Come to Parshat Bo last week. We had our first burst of mitzvot, and that was 20 in number, all of which related somehow to Yetziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus. Next week in Yitro, we'll have not only the mitzvot of the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, but we'll have a few others as well. 17 in total. The week after Mishpatim will have 53 mitzvot. Beshalach this week has one mitzvah, sort of. And the reason I say sort of is we have here a classical dispute between Rambam Maimonides and Ramban Nachmanides as to how one counts the mitzvot. According to Rambam Maimonides and the Sefer HaChinuch, who follows the Rambam almost completely, we have one mitzvah known as Tchum Shabbat, the Shabbat boundary. And according to Ramban, that's not a mitzvah from the Torah. It's a rabbinic mitzvah, which has its inspiration from the Torah, but it is not one of the 613 mitzvot. So first let's look at it from the Rambam and Sefer HaChinuch, that there is a mitzvat lo ta'aseh, a prohibition against a person leaving his Shabbat boundary. The context is the Torah's account of the mun, specifically that people went out on the Shabbat day to collect it, and they were told not to. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, God says to Moshe, Ad ona me'antem lishmor mitzvotai v'torotai. How long are you going to refuse to keep my Torah? Re'u ki Hashem natan lachem ha-Shabbat, God gave you the Shabbos, Al kein hu noten lachem bayom hashishi lechem yomayim. That's why he gave you a double portion of manna on Friday. Shivu ish tachtav. A person should sit in his own place, stay in his own place. Al yetze ish mimakomo bayom hashvi'i. A person shall not leave his place on the seventh day. Now, this needs, as most all of the Torah needs, the oral law in order to understand what it's saying. I'll tell it to you first in the form of an anecdote. Many years ago, a non-Jew named Sam, I don't remember his last name, from Texas, a guy around 40 years old at the time, came in to ask advice about conversion to Judaism. I was one of the addresses for that because I had taught in the Ulpan L'Giyur for 2.5 years, and people would come to ask advice. I didn't do anything that made a halachic change in a person's status, but I try to steer them in the right direction and screen them a little. So Sam comes into my office and tells me he wants to convert to Judaism. And before I could begin discussing anything with him, he says, but I don't want to become a regular Jew. I want to convert to become a biblical Jew. I had a sense of what he meant, but I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I've been reading the Bible for the last 5 years. And then the next sentence really made me smile. Mostly the Old Testament, mostly. And I'm convinced that in order to be an authentic Jew, excuse me, one needs to conform to the letter of the law as spelled out in the written Torah. I said, give me an example. He says, okay, there's a verse in Exodus, and he quotes, Al yetzei ish mimekomo bayom hashvi'i, a man shall not go out of his place on the seventh day. He said, I've been practicing how to keep Shabbat. Before each Shabbat, I bring my food, my reading material, and even a potty to my bed. And I stay in my bed the entire 24 hours of Shabbat. Because the Torah says, Al yetzei ish mimekomo bayom hashvi'i. When I said, that's not what it means, he said, that's what it says. I said, yes, but it means that a person shall not go out of his city or town or village or home, however he lives, for a certain distance outside that limit. No. You're telling me what the oral law says, and you're telling me what the commentaries say. I'm not interested in that. I want to be a biblical Jew. Had he been Jewish and was expressing these feelings, I would have felt like I needed to spend a lot of time with him. But since he was not Jewish, I said to him, look, you want to do these things? Go for it. I just have to tell you that you're not talking about Judaism. Not regular Judaism, not biblical Judaism. What you're describing is not Judaism. It's Bibleism, literalism. I said, I have a great idea. Why don't you call it Samism, named after yourself? It's not Judaism. And that was the end of the discussion, and I don't know what happened. But that was reminder, one of many, of the necessity of the oral law to explain the words of the Torah. You can read this portion in Bishalach as a story. Once upon a time, a long time ago, when the Jews first came out of Egypt, they were hungry, they complained for food. God gave them the manna. He said, don't leave it over for the next day, except on Friday a double portion will come. And there were people who did go out on Shabbat to collect man, and God got upset or angry, kivyachol, and he said, how long are they going to refuse to listen to me? Let them sit at home and not leave their, quote, place on the seventh day. The oral law gives a definition of place. If you live in a house all by itself with no neighbors, and you have a fence around your property, then you are restricted by the laws of Tchum Shabbat, Shabbos boundary, 2,000 amot in all directions. 2,000 amot is roughly a kilometer, about 0.7 miles, a little bit less. And if you live in a town, then the boundaries of the town from which you measure an additional 2,000 amot become the Tchum Shabbat, the Shabbos boundary of your place. And if you live in a city, the same thing goes. So a person can walk from Washington Heights in the upper part of Manhattan all the way down to the Bowery, many, many, many miles, without violating Shabbat Tchum. A person can walk from Gilo in Yerushalayim to Ramot and back, many miles, many kilometers, and not be in violation of Tchum Shabbat. Parenthetically, he might be in violation of some other aspect of Shabbat, of how you spend your time, but not a violation of Tchum because he has stayed in his place. His place being the island of Manhattan in the first example, or the city of Yerushalayim in the second example. Now, the Rambam says that the prohibited boundary of Tchum Shabbat, according to the Torah, is not 2,000 amot, it's 24,000 amot, also known as 12 mil, which would come to approximately 12 kilometers, significantly more than the 2,000 amot measure, the 1 kilometer measure. And the Rambam bases it on the size of the camp of Israel in the Midbar. There is a calculation as to how he gets those numbers, but he said if the context of this command was the encampment of the people of Israel in the Midbar, then that would define the biblical distance that one can walk outside of his place. However, the Rambam says that the rabbis, the sages, greatly shortened the boundary of Shabbat around one's dwelling place to only 2,000 amot, which is not derived from the encampment of the people, but it is derived from the description of the cities that the different tribes would give to the Levim when they came into Eretz Yisrael. And the city is described, the town is described, as having its own space, plus a city limit, so to speak, of 2,000 amot in all directions. Says the Rambam, that's the reason that the rabbis cut down Tchum Shabbat to 2,000 amot, 1 mil, approximately, only approximately 1 kilometer. The Ramban says this pasuk does not command Tchum Shabbat. Tchum Shabbat is a rabbinic requirement, limit of 2,000 amot in all directions, which means the Rambam and the Ramban do not argue about the halakha, the Jewish law of Shabbat boundary. They only argue as to whether the concept of Tchum Shabbat is biblical or rabbinic. But the Rambam, who says biblical, agrees that the rabbinic idea is equal to that which the Ramban gives as well, namely the 2,000 amot limit. Now, if a person can walk from Gilo to Ramot, then what does it mean to have a limit on how far you could walk on Shabbat? The answer is how much you could walk is not limited. How far away from your domain, which in the case of a city includes the whole city, you can walk. It's not a matter of physical exertion. It's a matter of, are you staying home or are you on the move? The weekday is for being on the move. Shabbat is for staying at home. That does not mean you don't go to shul, and it doesn't mean you don't go visit people, but all within the halachic guidelines of one's dwelling place, and of one's Tchum Shabbat. I want to make something very clear. We're not talking about carrying. Carrying has its own guidelines, and one may only carry in a Reshut HaYachid, or an area that was turned into a Reshut HaYachid halachically. And that's another issue, not Tchum. Tchum means you're in a vacation cottage in the boondocks, also known as Yenemsveld, all by itself, a secluded home where the nearest house is a number of kilometers away, then you have a boundary beyond which you may not walk on Shabbat with empty pockets, not carrying anything. You may not walk more than approximately 1 kilometer in any direction from your property. So that's two separate things, even though different interpretations of the verse that we've been talking about can include carrying as well as walking, and that confuses the issue. But the bottom line is, according to Rambam and Sefer Achinuch, there is one mitzvah in Parshat Peshalach, and that is the prohibition of going outside one's Shabbat boundary, known as Tchum Shabbat. I could say remember the Pesach Seder, but that's almost 10 months in the past. But we know the Pesach Seder, and believe it or not, it's coming up in a little bit more than 2 months. This coming Monday is Tu B'Shvat. A month later is Purim. And a month after that is Pesach. In any event, one of the well-known parts of the Seder recitation is the song poem Dayenu, in which we say, among other things, Ilu Natan Lanu Et HaShabbat. Had you only given us the Shabbat, Velo Natan Lanu, Velo Kervanu Lifnei Har Sinai, and not brought us near Mount Sinai, and then subsequently to give us the Torah, Dayenu, we would have sufficient cause to thank you. Now, commandment number 4 in the Aseret HaDibrot is Shabbat. Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadosho. And then the prohibition of Lo Tasevo Kol Malacha. And that's in the experience of Sinai. What came before was a first introduction to Shabbat, which included and was based on the Mun and the guidelines set down of preparing for Shabbat on a Friday and resting on Shabbat and not leaving your place and not going out to collect Mun. This was the first introduction, formal introduction, that the people had to Shabbat, to the point where the author of Dayenu can say that we already had the mitzvah of Shabbat roughly a couple of weeks before Ma'amad Har Sinai, before the Sinai experience. And that was a foundation upon which was built the more formal presentation of Shabbat in Parshat Yitro and then again in Parshat Mishpatim. But we had the Shabbat first. We also have a remez, a hint, which the sages grabbed upon to require 3 Shabbos meals. We're talking about agricultural societies where the norm was 2 meals a day, one after you did your first stint in the fields or in the barns in the morning, and another one in the evening when you came back home. And Shabbat was honored by having 3 meals on Shabbat, not just 2. Now, for those people that have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, sort of seems funny to focus on a third Shabbos meal, because people have meals three times every day. Be that as it may, the concept of shalosh su'udot, three Shabbos meals, is hinted at in a pasuk, Vayomer Moshe. Moshe told the people, Ichluhu hayom, eat the mon today. Ki Shabbat hayom lashem, for today is Shabbat. Hayom lo timtzu'uhu basadeh, today you will not find it in the field. The word hayom is used three times in the context of eating on Shabbat day, and the sages derive their inspiration for requiring three Shabbos meals from that verse. On a practical level, in the winter time, especially when Shabbat ends fairly early, if you've checked your calendar lately, we are getting later each Shabbat now, but we're still on the early side. Then sometimes a third Shabbat meal is not a very exciting prospect. People had a wonderful dinner on Friday night in honor of Shabbat, and they had a big lunch on Shabbat day, maybe even preceded by Kiddush with some cake or other goodies. And between the food eaten at the Kiddush and the food eaten at lunch, they would rather take a nap in the afternoon than have another meal. And Chazal recognized this by saying that, on the one hand, if the meal is not looked forward to because one is full, then he can suffice the requirement of Su'udah Shlishit, third Shabbos meal, with a token, crackers, or a piece of cake, and does not need to make a full meal out of it. On the other hand, it is proper to have a full meal with washing for Hamotzi, with having Lechem Mishnah, and with having something to eat to qualify this as a proper meal, which is followed by Birkat HaMazon and is known as Su'udah Shlishit. What this requires, or what is recommended for this, is being a little bit more sensible when it comes to what you eat at a Kiddush and what you eat for lunch. You might say, for example, that we're going to bench now from lunch and we'll have dessert later for Su'udah Shlishit, or rearrange in some way. There are people who go to an early mincha on Shabbos afternoon, so they're able to bench from lunch, then go to mincha, and then wash for hamotzi and have some decent semblance of Su'udah Shlishit. It is something that our sages have determined for us, that this is proper honor for Shabbat, and it's something that we should take seriously. I can't go into all of the details about Su'udah Shlishit. A lot of what I've said is subjective in my feeling of how important it is and how stepped on it is in some communities. Women should know that women are obligated on Su'udah Shlishit just like men. And many communities that provide a Su'udah Shlishit, usually to the men who come to shul for mincha and then later for ma'ariv on Shabbos afternoon and early evening, will have their Su'udah Shlishit and leave their families to their own devices, which usually means, or often means, no Su'udah Shlishit. Families should plan on a respectful and delicious Su'udah Shlishit that will not be an overburden on the people because they controlled their consumption earlier. You want another portion of chont? Tell you what, why don't you wait until Su'udah Shlishit or something like that. Let me finish this edition of Torah Tidbits Audio with something related to Tu B'Shvat. The Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah describes four different New Year's days. New Year's for the trees is known as Tu B'Shvat, is known as Rosh Hashanah La'ilanot, and I mentioned last week or the week before that Beit Shammai felt it should have been on Rosh Chodesh Shvat. Hillel's opinion is the one that prevails at the 15th of Shvat, marking the midpoint within the winter months. Winter months of Tevet, Shvat, and Adar. Middle month is the 15th of Shvat. What does it mean? Well, it has a halachic significance in certain agricultural mitzvot, which apply in Eretz Yisrael. But it has a conceptual concept doesn't sound right. It has a conceptual idea of recognizing the renewal of nature, which renews itself at different times of the year, but the one preceding the spring, when traditionally you could go out on Tu B'Shvat and already see almond trees, the Shkedia, in blossom. And it's not really until Nisan, which we recognize the emergence of nature after the dead of winter, but Tu B'Shvat sort of has a beginning of that as well. In Israel and elsewhere, there are traditions that have come down through certain groups and communities and then have crossed over to other ones. I'm thinking of the Tu B'Shvat Seder, which is a Kabbalistic thing. I don't know its history, but it involves white wine representing winter, and then white wine with a little red wine as you get closer to spring, and then more red and less white, and then only red, and all kind of symbolic fruits, specifically the Shivat Haminim, the seven species, as well as fruits that have a skin which we remove and we eat the rest, or we eat and there's a pit inside which we don't eat, or we have both a skin and a pit, or we eat the whole fruit without taking anything away from it. And these have all kind of symbolisms. I'm not the right person to explain them. One thing I will say is that there's a lot of fruits, especially dried fruits, even the ones of Shivat Haminim, the seven species, that are not grown in Eretz Yisrael. And I think that people should try. Here in Israel, it's easier. Outside of Israel, the dried figs, for example, that were very common at Tu B'Shvat time, probably come from Turkey. And the dried dates, don't know where they come from. And raisins come from California. And if you're doing Tu B'Shvat right, no matter where you are, you should try to get raisins from grapes that were grown in Israel and figs that were grown in Israel and dates that were grown in Israel and oranges and many, many other fruits too. There are people who frown upon dried fruits altogether and go for only fresh fruits. But there's an underlying hakpada, an insistence that they be fruits of Eretz Yisrael. I remember as a kid in Brooklyn, the parents would prepare Tu B'Shvat bags for the kids, which contained a piece of buxer that nobody knew what to eat, how to eat it, and a dried fig and a dried date and some raisins and some almonds. And I wonder how much of that was from Eretz Yisrael, even though they were reminders of Eretz Yisrael, and we plugged into Tu B'Shvat in that way. Here in Israel, it's a little bit more native and a little bit more celebrated and paid attention to. And there's a review of the agricultural mitzvot, which is appropriate, as well as a review of brachot, because that's the other end of planting and harvesting, is the actual consumption preceded by a bracha, and people have to know what brachot to say on different foods and different fruits. I'll just mention one example of that and finish with this. It's one of my favorite halachic conundrums. But first, the background. If a person is going to eat apple and grapes, both of which are borei pri ha'etz, the preferred order in which to eat and which fruit to say the bracha on, according to Shulchan Aruch, are the grapes, because they are one of the seven species from the famous verse, Eretz Chita Usora, V'Gefen Uteinav Rimon, Eretz Zeit Shemen Udvash. And then the apple goes along for the ride with the bracha. If one has an apple and a banana, the apple getting a borei pri ha'etz and the banana getting a borei pri ha'adamah, most people think the apple has priority, but according to the halacha, whichever one you like better has priority. So if you like banana more than you like an apple, you would make a borei pri ha'adamah on the banana and then a borei pri ha'etz on the apple. When you have a banana and a grape and grapes, there it's interesting. If you like them both the same, or you like grapes more, then certainly the grapes go first. But if you like banana more than grapes, then we do not say, again, according to Shulchan Aruch, we do not say that you make the bracha on Shivat Haminim, the seven species, first, because there are two separate brachot, and you're going to be making two separate brachot, and therefore the grapes will get a bracha, but you should make the first bracha on that which you favor. So if you favor banana over grapes, the borei pri ha'adamah goes first, and then the borei pri ha'etz on the grapes. With that said, here's the conundrum. I'll use a practical example, even though I spoke against dried fruit, for people who eat dried fruit. You have raisins, you have dried apricot, and banana chips. Raisins are ha'etz, dried apricot are ha'etz, banana chips are ha'adamah. Your favorite among these three is dried apricot. Your second favorite is banana. And your least favorite, or let's say third favorite, are the raisins. But you are going to partake of all of them. On which do you say a bracha and what bracha first? If you say raisins, because they are Shivat Haminim, and they have priority over the dried apricot, then I have to remind you that the banana, no, I lost that. Yeah, that the banana, which you like more than the raisins, should get the bracha first. So if you take a banana to make a borei pri ha'etz, I will remind you that the apricots should go first because you like apricots better than you like banana. But if you take an apricot to make the bracha, I will remind you that the raisins are Shivat Haminim and they have priority over the apricots. So here we have apricots over banana, banana over raisins, raisins over apricots. And we have a vicious circle here without a clear answer as to what bracha you make and in what order. Now, there are some people, I hope not you, there are some Jews who will say, come on, what difference does it make? Just take something and eat it. And others will say, this is an interesting riddle. And how do you answer it? Now, I asked this question many years ago of many different rabbis. And Rabbi Reuven Abraman, Zichrono Livracha, gave me what I thought was the best answer. He said, usually we follow the halacha as set down by Shulchan Aruch. When that is not possible, as in this case, because you won't be able to eat anything without something else having a priority over it, then you need to find, which is easy to find, another opinion, which we don't usually follow, which will solve the problem. Now, Shulchan Aruch very rarely quotes the Rambam, even though the Shulchan Aruch is based on the Rambam, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, and the Rif, Rabbeinu Alfasi. But he does not tell you often the dissenting opinion or the different opinion of the Rambam from the one that the Shulchan Aruch says is halacha. In the case of priority and brachot, he mentions what the Rambam says. And he says, not that you should do it that way, but you should know that that's the Rambam's opinion. And that is your first choice of making a bracha within the fruits and Borei Pri Ha'adamah realm. There are other guidelines when you get to other brachot. We're not getting into that now. But the rule of thumb is you honor that which you like best first. And therefore, if the Shulchan Aruch is not going to work in apricot has a priority to the banana, and banana has a priority over raisins, and raisins has a priority over apricots, and apricots over banana, and banana over raisins, and raisins over apricot, etc., etc., then go to the Rambam. The Rambam says, whichever you like best goes first. So the Rambam would say, I don't have a problem with this. And he'll take an apricot, if he likes that the best, and make a borei pri ha'etz, and cover the raisins, and then make also a hadamah on the banana chips, and everything is happy. So the conundrum only exists in the context of the Shulchan Aruch's psak. I say only because we're supposed to follow what the Shulchan Aruch sets down. But the Rambam comes to the rescue in this case, and I thought that was a beautiful kind of solution. And I say it now in memory of Rabbi Reuven Abraman, who was a very, very fine person and a very fine Jew and a wonderful teacher. On that note, I will wish you Shabbat Shalom, Tu Bishvat Sameach, I guess, Lehishtameach.